Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I'm Eleanor Robson. I'm the chair of the Institute's Governing Council. I'd like to welcome you all, and I'd particularly like to welcome our new Vice President, the Iraqi Ambassador to London. It's a sad time to be meeting, of course. I'm sure many of you here today have friends and families you're worried about in Baghdad, in the north of Iraq. I hope that they're all safe and well. We've had news over the last week or so from all our colleagues and friends in Mosul in particular, and I'm happy to report that everyone that we've been in contact with is safe for now. In Baghdad, our colleagues in the Iraq National Library and Archives are preparing for the worst, but hoping that that won't happen. But so far, at least for the people, so good. Now, of course, we're an organisation developed to support research and education into Iraq's heritage, its culture, its civilizations, its literature, its languages, its history. And those are all things that are created by people, individuals, communities, societies. So we can't really separate, as far as I'm concerned, the tragedy that's happening to the individuals and the people of Iraq at the moment with their past culture, their present culture, their future culture. And perhaps some of you who are on Facebook and or Twitter may know already, or you receive our emails, that together with the Blue Shield, the Institute issued a statement earlier this week on the protection of Iraqi cultural heritage sites. Now, Blue Shield is the international organisation which is tasked with upholding the 1954 Hague Convention on the Protection of Cultural Heritage during armed conflict. And we work very closely with the UK branch, partly because the British government has still to ratify that international convention from 1954. So I serve on that committee on your behalf to lobby the UK government. Iraq, on the other hand, has been a signatory to the convention since 1967. So we can be sure that from the Iraqi end that cultural heritage could be protected. Of course, we can't at all guarantee that the insurgents at ISIS will be looking out for Iraq's heritage. And we don't expect at all that this statement will make a tiny bit of difference to them. But what it will do, we hope, is alert the international community to the fact that Iraq's cultural heritage matters not only to us in this room, but to Iraqis both in Iraq and all over the world. And the response that we've had from individuals and community groups since we issued this statement has been incredibly empowering. It's currently being translated into Arabic, so that will be going out hopefully tomorrow as well. There are copies of it downstairs, links, it's up on our website. So I hope you will play your part too in reminding the people that you talk to why Iraq's culture matters so much to you and why it should matter to all of us. Now, it's a tradition that this June meeting begins with what we call the Bonham Carter Forum, after one of our benefactors, to allow you, the members of the society, the Institute, to ask questions of me and the trustees of the charity about what we've been doing over the past 12 months. So we had already planned to have this session anyway, but I really did want to foreground the events of the current time and to say that we've discussed at Council this afternoon how we should be responding in the immediate and long term. As far as we're concerned, continuing to do what we do is an important act of resistance to the barbarians who are trying to destroy the country, and an act of support to our colleagues and friends in Iraq whom we work with, that their work is valuable and should continue, and we should try to do what we can to continue to support them. So as part of that general process of increasing our support to colleagues in Iraq. We've, over the past 12 months, been developing a new fundraising strategy, which you saw I wrote to you about in the past, with the past newsletter, sorry, the past mailing, and target with a 5-year plan to increase our work in education and research in Iraq, as well as continuing and growing our activities in this country. Now, that will all be subject to review on a case-by-case basis, but as it happens, our only project in the north was with colleagues at the University of Mosul on an online education project. Those colleagues are, the last we heard from before internet went down, all okay, and the work is an online project anyway, and involved bringing them here to the UK to work with us rather than anyone going there. So that's the only potentially at-risk project we see at the moment. So as far as we're concerned, we think we can continue, all things being equal, as we had planned. But we will be, as always, monitoring the situation and taking advice from our colleagues in Iraq about what's appropriate and feasible to do. So, over to you. Do you have any questions for me or anything that you would like us to be thinking about doing, how we should be responding? Oh, one last thing, sorry, I forgot to say, that we also agreed in council that I will be writing to the press on the Institute's behalf, hopefully together with the chair of the UK Blue Shield and the British Association for Near Eastern Archaeology, to draw attention to this statement and just to reiterate in more condensed form the sorts of things that I've been saying to you this evening about why we think that Iraq's heritage should matter and be a matter of concern for all parties engaged in the conflict at the moment. So, does anyone have any questions or comments or points they want to make? Yes, it's been a lot better. The British government have dropped the cost of applications for visas, and our last two visiting scholars didn't have any problems. A year ago, it was very, very difficult. I don't know whether our new ambassador has had anything to do with smoothing the visa application process, but it really has. It has been noticeably better. And the British government, I think, are opening an application centre again in Basra, aren't they? Are they opening in Basra now? Yeah. I mean, it's all up in the air right now. Would you like to?
Hello, good evening. As far as the visa to Iraq is concerned, we have made the whole process very easy. The whole process of having visa to Iraq has become very easy. Anyone who would like to go to Iraq for work or research or anything, they should bring a recommendation letter from their offices, and after that, it will take perhaps less than 2 days.
We grant visa. Our process for getting grant holders working in country in Iraq in transport, and there will be our project running for a regional archaeology project. Thanks to the question.
Some of the news that some of the British citizens who have been involved in these sort of terrorist activities in Syria and Iraq has made things perhaps a little bit worse. However, there are quite a pressure put upon Home Office to make this entrance of relevant people easier, these procedures easier. So far, we have not found any response from them, but that's the Foreign and Commonwealth Ministry have demanded that. The Parliament constantly do that. We ourselves say that this strict rule of entering UK is hindering. They are hindering trade. For instance, it's incredible that the trade volume between Iraq and UK would be less than 1 billion. It's strange. Of course, the oil sector are doing a little bit better, but usually they are not counted. There are lots of people who are necessary to come here. Some of them are ministers, officials who have meetings, who have appointments, and they're supposed to be here to do a serious and important work. But at least I can't do anything about that, but ask them every now and then. However, as it, the matter concerns the other way around, we have met very easy. This last week, perhaps over 150 journalists, reporters, yes, have got visa to go to the country to report what's happening there. And I must thank you and all of you for your concern for our country. And I think that country is important for everybody to get to stability, to a stable condition. And I don't have much to say, but there have been lots of mistakes, no denial about that. Lots of mistakes accumulated, which led to this situation. However, I'm not, inshallah, telling you something, but there are serious attempts that the leadership of the political parties are coming together. On the 13th of June, the Iraqi parliament would convene, and serious work is going to be done to establish a new government and there to go forward, because everybody is sure, we first of all, that the dissatisfaction of the Sunni Muslims, who were instrumental actually in 2006-2007 to throw out these terrorists right in the beginning, were the Sunni Arabs themselves. If the local population are not satisfied, doors would be open. We do believe, we are uniform in believing that the only line of defense is that satisfaction and the feel of dignity of our own people within this political system. And that's what we have to work for. And anyway, news stream out of the country, and day by day things are changing, and but there are serious attempts to turn the whole thing the other way around, and I don't believe that they will stay there, because they are very dangerous for the local population, which are the Sunnis. They're supposed to, under the banner of defending the Sunni Muslims, they're causing the most serious threat to the population themselves. 500,000 people have come to the borders of the Kurdish region from the terror of these groups. Thank you very much.
It's incredibly helpful and heartening. Is there anything else anybody would like to ask or say at this point before we move on? Okay, super. Do come and talk to either of us or any of the trustees of the Institute during the reception. So let's move on now to the academic part of the evening before the social, more social part towards the end. It's my real pleasure and delight to welcome to the podium this evening Dr. Nalida Fukaro. She's a council member of BISI and has been a very valuable addition to our council. She's a historian of the modern Middle East, but she specializes in Iraq, of course, that's why she's here, but also on the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula, the Kurdish areas. And she's also very keen in cross-regional interdisciplinary approaches to the Middle East. She's worked on Kurdish political and social history around ethnicity, colonialism, and nationalism. But for the last 15 years, she's studied the history of urban space and societies in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf and Iraq. She's currently leading an international project on the history of urban violence in the Middle East, how germane, with colleagues in Berlin, and writing a history of urban violence for Cambridge University Press. More recently, she's been developing an interest in the social and cultural history of the Middle Eastern oil industry, and we'll be hearing more about that in a minute, and has edited a thematic contribution for the journal Comparative Studies in South Asia, Africa, and Middle East, entitled Histories of Oil and Urban Modernity in the Middle East. So Nalida is incredibly well-placed here to tell us about oil cultures in Iraq under the monarchy and to show us some what going to be look like really fabulous pictures, as well as telling us very interesting things. I'm sure we'll learn a lot. So Nalida's going to talk for 50 minutes to an hour. There'll be a chance for questions afterwards, and then we will adjourn to the room at the back for conversation, nibbles, and drinks. Nalida, over to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very, very much for this wonderful introduction, and perhaps too generous. And thank you very much also for giving me this opportunity to speak to you this evening. I'm going to tell you some happy stories, some perhaps less happy stories, but I hope that, you'll enjoy this talk. Just to give a bit of background, in this talk I'm actually mixing some of my work that I've been doing on urban violence, particularly with reference to the oil industry, but also my new work on the social and cultural history of the oil industry. And in particular, so this is very much work in progress, so you have to excuse me if you find some shortcomings. Particularly on what I'm going to say about Iraq in terms of oil and these new cultures of oil. My work is at the moment very comparative, so I'm working on Iraq, Kuwait, and Bahrain, but of course I'm going to focus on Iraq. Let me first of all start with the question, is oil a blessing or a curse? And, of course, one would say it's a blessing. If you look at these pretty stunning pictures, which were published in 1957 in Iraq Petroleum, which was the magazine of the Iraq Oil Company, Iraq Petroleum Company. Now, this is the question that many scholars and analysts of oil development have been posing for some time. A question that, of course, has got a lot of resonance in the history of Iraq, both past and present. Now, in this talk, I'm not going to discuss. I'm telling you what I'm not going to do, just to warn you. The effect of oil on the economy, politics, and geopolitics of monarchical Iraq. What I want to do instead is to show different and contrasting aspects of oil life and culture in the Iraq of the 1940s and 1950s. In this sense, I want to unpack the history of Iraqi oil, a story that, has often been hijacked by nationalism, geopolitics, and the political economy of oil development. In other words, I'm very interested in the ambiguous face of oil, but also its social manifestation and its impact on people's lives. On the one hand, and focusing on Kirkuk, I will illustrate how oil generated social and political inequality, prompted the political mobilization of workers, and generated contestation, abuse, and sometimes violence. So these are the less happy stories. The idea, of course, here is that oil is as a corporate enterprise and as a monster of wealth, has unleashed its sinister powers, disrupting lives and physical landscapes. On the other, and this is the happy part of my story, I will discuss what some have defined the effects of the oil magic. How, in some cases, oil changed people's lives for the better, brought about new lifestyles and new ideas of modern urban living. And there is an interest, of course, in cities and urban living that I have, which is a very important part of my work. Now, at the moment, I'm particularly interested in how the Iraq Petroleum Company and, to some extent, the Hashemite government in Iraq use what I call the oil propaganda, but don't take it necessarily in a negative sense. It's a bit like what we would say today, branding. So it's not necessarily a negative, it hasn't got necessarily a negative connotation, oil propaganda. So I will look at how IPC, the Iraq Petroleum Company, used oil propaganda to create particular images of Iraq's oil bonanza, which focused on the life of oil workers and on the modern urban environments, villas, new oil towns, and so forth, where they lived. Now, let me a few words on Kirkuk as the center of Iraq oil's industry. Now, of course, this is Begasha at Baba Gurgur well, where oil was discovered in the late 1920s. Oil was discovered in the outskirts of Kirkuk in the late 1920s, and its extraction and transportation to the Mediterranean coast through a set of parallel pipelines was in the hands of the Iraq Petroleum Company, an enterprise with American, French, and Italian shareholders, but with close links to the British government through the participation of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which, of course, had a majority share in IPC. A locality known as Baba Gurgur, to the northwest of the town of Kirkuk then, was a place where the first oil well was drilled. And you see here the Baba Gurgur Gasher and another one. These are actually photos, I think, from 1929, 1930. Now, in the poetic imagery of Anwar al-Ghassani, a Kirkuk-born writer, the flames of Baba Gurgur, known as the Eternal Fire, were the symbol of Kirkuk and of Iraq as a whole. Quote, of its wealth, energy, and unbounded and eternally rebellious soul, end of quote. Oil was also the source of a peculiar feature of Kirkuk's landscape that you see here. Its nitrate skies caused by the natural combustion of gas and oil around the city. And this is a photograph which was taken in 1945 of this oil sort of fields around Kirkuk. The oil installations that develop around the Baba Gurgur oil fields created contrasting human and industrial landscapes, captured in a series of photographs commissioned by Life magazine in late 1945, soon after the Second World War. And this is one of these photographs. It's pretty stunning. I mean, the original, it's very, very high quality. Of course, this is an Arab shepherd. On the background, you see the oil installations, camels, classic landscape, and then pumps, technology, the oil industry. Now, starting in the early 1930s, the oil company built an entirely new town in the northwestern outskirts of Kirkuk. This was a modern administrative, residential, and industrial complex described by a local resident as, quote, British in design and atmosphere, a piece of Europe combined with local features, end quote. It included the new camp, which was the administrative headquarter of IPC, which also accommodated the management, and the Arapa Estate, a residential area which was built after 1946 for the local employees of the company, for Iraqis. In Kirkuk, IPC had its own police force, and by the mid-1950s, a hospital, railway station, a training center for locals, sports grounds, and various clubs for European and local staff. Now, both the new town, IPC headquarters, and the Arapa Estate, which became known as Kirkuk al-Jadida, the new Kirkuk, represented exclusive, modern, and glamorous, or at least were considered to be exclusive, modern, and glamorous living spaces and workspaces, of course. Now, this is a photograph which was taken sometime before 1948. This is an interesting photograph. Let me just use the pointer. This is taken from the northeast, and this is basically the IPC headquarters. Here, watchmen barracks, and on the background, you see Kirkuk town, and I think this is the citadel of Kirkuk. So you can see how actually the headquarters of IPC were quite isolated from the town at the time, and this really reminds me a lot of certain type of colonial towns which were built by Europeans quite far away from the native town of the colonized. And so this is also an idea that comes up. But then, of course, what happens? This is a photograph of the actual headquarters of IPC. I think it's 1958. Yes, it's a 1958 photograph. What you see, of course, here is that, okay, here you still have a headquarters. I think the Arapa estate would be somewhere here, is not actually pictured in the photo. But then you see the town on the background. And the town actually progressively expanded to become closer and closer with, of course, the urbanization of the 50s and the 60s to become closer to the IPC headquarters. Now, let me move on from this, from oil urbanism, that is how oil affected actually the shape and the looks of Kirkuk as a town, to a fictional, yet a very intimate, I think, human portrayal of the effects of oil, which stands as an allegory for the multifaceted powers of this substance, powers to both allure and disgrace individuals and to disrupt their lives. The Kirkuk-born writer Abbas al-Azawi, in his novel The Last of the Angels, a nostalgic and partly autobiographical recollection of life in Kirkuk in the 1940s and 50s, relates a very amusing story, a very much tongue-in-cheek story. This is fictional, of course. The story of Hamid Nailon, a resident of the old Al-Chakur quarter and one of the thousands of people employed in the oil industry. Just to give you a sense, in 1955, according to IPC statistics, data, some 5,000 Iraqis were directly employed by IPC in what they call the Kirkuk fields, of course inclusive of clerical and technical staff and unskilled laborers. Now, let me go back to Hamid now. Rumors circulated, and this is of course a fictional story, in Al-Shakur and the quarter, that Hamid was sacked by the oil company as a result of his attempts to seduce the British wife of Mr. McKinley, an IPC engineer, for whom Hamid worked as a personal driver. The casus belli was a pair of nylon stockings, which Hamid had allegedly bought as a present for Mrs. McKinley, eager to win her affection. Yet, unfortunately for him, Hamid's attempts failed. Mrs. McKinley slapped him in the face and accused him of trying to assault her. Now, Hamid was thus fired and was given the nickname Nylon, of course, Nylon, by which he became known for the rest of his life. Hamid's only, that's an interesting one, comment to his misfortune was, quote, "The only true thing in any of these stories is the nylon stockings," end quote. Hamid's dismissal from the oil company led to a protest by quarter residents, which merged into the activities of a labor union and eventually led to a confrontation with the police. These episodes triggered Hamid's political coming of age. He starts flirting with the communists and later on concocting plans for a revolution. There are a number of key elements. As I said, this is very much a tongue-in-cheek story, the way it is narrated by the author. But there are a number of key elements in this story. The nylon stockings and the voluptuous body of Mrs. McKinley symbolize the glamorous appeal of oil and its transgressive powers, its ability to create a fatal attraction for modern lifestyles, unconventional social behavior, and consumer culture. Oil's appeal, however, caused Amit also, of course, personal humiliation, loss of employment, and, as hinted by the accusation, of course, of sexual assault, violence. Oil in the story also, of course, becomes a means through which Hamid becomes politically conscious, but not only Hamid, but also the residents of the quarter, marking their involvement with the union and the communist movement, which in the 1940s and 1950s, that probably as many of you know, was at the forefront of underground labor politics. So in some important ways, Hamid's story epitomizes the violent history, or the difficult history, let's say, of Kirkuk's oil during the monarchy as the industrial force that shaped labor unrest, political militancy, and in some cases, repression. The city's oil crowds, particularly the multitude of individuals employed as menial workers, normally with very, very sort of just 1 day or 2 days contracts and so forth, share confrontational emotions and grievances against the oil company, and you know, arbitrary dismissals, employment policies, and low wages. But there was no outbreak of large-scale unrest until the end of the Second World War. Yet, before a war, a new culture of protest emerged. Initially, it was very peaceful. The silent and orderly work stoppages staged in 7 of the old station located along the pipeline that brought Kirkuk oil to the Mediterranean are a case in point. Now, this is just to give you a sense of the geopolitics of all this, and then I'll explain what happened in the oil station. This is Kirkuk, and this is the pipeline. You see there is a series of parallel pipelines. Of course, in K3 here, still in Iraqi territory, they diverged, and this was the actual branch who took oil to the Syrian, to Tripoli, and then to Banias, basically northern Syrian coast, and then you have the Haifa pipeline, which transported the oil to Palestine. The Haifa pipeline, of course, was closed in 1947, 1948. So, but just to say that basically you have Kirkuk through this network of pipelines that is linked to the Mediterranean. And actually, the stoppages, the work stoppages, spread from Baba Gurgur oil fields in Kirkuk to K1, which was basically the first oil station along the pipeline, then to K2, K3, and then to some of these stations here in some of them, of course, in Syrian territory on the Haifa pipeline. Now, these work stoppages involved technical staff, daily wage workers, and even cooks and servants, so the ways in which it was quite a movement. It was, however, Iraq's brief war with Britain in 1941 and the British military occupation of Kirkuk during the Second World War that set the stage for the explosion of industrial conflict. Now, I've got here, this is a British Indian soldier guarding an oil well, and this, I think, was a photo which was taken in 1944. Now, the war economy had far-reaching repercussions on the most vulnerable section of the urban population of Kirkuk. With large number of residents below the subsistence level, microcriminality, theft, disease, and psychological instability increased. And, of course, reduced activity in the oil field because of the war, it unskilled laborers quite hard. As the company started to distribute essential commodities such as sugar, wheat, rice, and firewood at fixed prices to its employees, hungry and desperate job seekers turn up daily in large numbers at the gates of the oil installations. And this has been reported quite a lot in eyewitnesses' accounts and official reports. They were refused employment on the grounds either that they were not needed, of course there was much less work because of the war, or that they were unfit for work as a result of their poor physical and mental conditions. So to give you the sense of the sufferings of the urban population, At the end of the war, the close links between mounting underground activism and food scarcity is made explicit, or was made explicit, in a pamphlet circulating among Kurdish workers linked to the communist movement in early 1946, encouraging the workers to unionize. Using a collective voice, the pamphlet articulates in fairly simple terms their distress. Quote, "We have been deprived of the wheat allotted to us, and many a night have we slept without food," end quote. After the war, for the first time in the history of the Iraq oil industry, IPC workers came out with their demands: wage increases, housing and rent allowances, social security, insurance against unemployment and injury, and the establishment of unions to prevent arbitrary dismissals. In July 1946, the police opened fire indiscriminately against demonstrators in central Kirkuk. Several reports suggest that the security forces shot protesters while they were trying to escape, and their horses stampeded over the bodies of the dead and injured lying on the ground. There are several reports of this incident. At the end, official figures reported 5 people killed and 14 injured, including 6 policemen. Now, Fadil al-Azawi, again, which fictionalizes this incident, provides quite a lively insight into the strike. He visualizes the crowd of protesters as a multitude of men, women, and children, suddenly frightened by rumors of the impending arrival of mounted policemen. They were in central Kirkuk in a garden. I mean, the workers had assembled there just to discuss the tactics for the strike and so forth. Quote, "Fear drove the workers to greater zeal, and they shouted even louder," end quote. Azawi writes, depicting acrimonious verbal battles between protesters and the police. While the crowd waved back and forth as policemen started to charge the strikers who refused to disperse. Now, what is also interesting about Al-Azawi's account of this particular episode is that at the end of the strike, it portrays the crowd as very silent and submissive. Quote, "They avoided each other's eyes for fear their hearts' shame would show. They couldn't do anything about it." Now, and this is this kind of fictional representation of defeat and powerlessness and humiliation, in fact, corroborates contemporary accounts of Kirkuk after the strike. As a matter of fact, between 1946 and 1959, when you had sort of large-scale disturbances, the city remained relatively quiet in comparison with the rest of Iraq. And actually, if you look at why the city remained quiet, of course, the city became under a strict surveillance regime, both by, you know, IPC had their police, their watchmen, and so also, but also by the government, particularly the Central Investigation Department of the Ministry of the Interior. So what happens in 1946, and then in a minute I'm going to stop with the less sort of happy picture. After 1946, what is quite interesting, unrest, labor unrest, moves to the old stations around Kirkuk, because obviously they were less guarded, less controlled, and so forth. For instance, in 1948, in quite a well-known episode, for 10 days, militant workers took over K3, one of the oil stations, the largest and most important oil station located at the intersection of the Haifa and Tripoli branches of the pipeline. No acts of sabotage and vandalism against IPC properties were reported at the time, and the British personnel were largely unscathed, it seems. Orchestrated by the Iraqi Communist Party, the strike was seemingly an orderly and disciplined movement reminiscent of the work stoppages of 1937. Yet, the imposition of communist order in K3 can be read as an act of policing in reverse. Typically, he relied on a number of committees to organize key activities such as meetings, discussion groups, negotiation with the company and security. The workforce was disciplined, organized, and indoctrinated in some ways. Undesirable, into inverted commas, I'm not going to go into where the undesirables, there were many. Undesirables were expelled from the station. Intimidation and bullying were also used against the family of some of the Christian clerks, Iraqi Christian clerks of the company, who were unwilling to join the strike. This is to say that this aspect, perhaps less happy aspects, aspect of this culture of oil militancy produced coercion and, in some cases, violence on both sides, implicating not only security forces, the oil company, government or whatever, but also activists, sometimes, and ordinary people. Now, so this is how oil life could happen on the ground, defined by political confrontation, daily struggles for employment at the company gates, and routine encounters with IPC and government security. Yet, for some, this life also meant comfortable housing, a modern lifestyle, and the realization of a dream for a better future. Take, for instance, Sargon Joseph Halaby, a Christian born in Kirkuk, whose father worked in the oil station in K3 during the Second World War as the manager of the station supermarket. He recalls, now he lives in Australia, I think, quote, "Our living quarters in K3, which were supplied by the company, were beautiful, and we had three large bedrooms. The houses were built of local stone, and everything was provided, such as furniture, linen, crockery, and cutlery. We had hot water 24 hours a day and could shower whenever we wanted to. The homes were heated during the very cold winters. We lived very well there." End quote. At the beginning of the 1950s, such happy stories of oil development and modernization became the object of public relation efforts orchestrated by the oil company, by IPC, in order to popularize new and positive images of Iraq's oil industry. There was, of course, a political rationale to it. As dissent fueled by nationalism, communism, and anti-imperialism threatened British interest in Iraq, IPC embarked on an orchestrated campaign of prestige publicity, branding, we will call it now. This publicity created new imaginaries of oil, which featured prominently IPC Iraqi employees, like Hamid Nailon, of course, their work and family lives, as well as modern urban environments with which oil development had become increasingly identified. The 1950s, of course, and many of you will know, were also a period when, throughout the Middle East, the interest of foreign oil companies and local governments increasingly converged, following, of course, the renegotiation of oil agreements, which entitled governments to half of oil royalties. And this started in Saudi Arabia, but then it spread to Iraq. In this context, and after the negotiation of Iraq's oil agreement in 1952, the oil company, IPC, and the monarchical regime became increasingly close partners in new strategies of national development. In a broadcast aired by Iraq State TV in 1955 on the occasion of the Baghdad Trade Fair, the oil industry was portrayed as one of the workshops in charge of forging a new nation. IPC was praised not only for producing conscientious technicians, but also for creating, and I quote here, "a stable, contented body of men who work in an atmosphere of order and fairness, whose moral influence was essential to, of course, produce good citizens." So you can see how the oil company very much was in partnership with the government. Now, what were the mediums of this oil propaganda? And that's what I'm actually quite interested in. And as I said, my work is quite comparative. I'm doing Iraq, Kuwait, in Bahrain in terms of this oil propaganda. Now, IPC acted as its own advertising agent through a variety of public relation efforts that targeted employees, the Iraqi government, but also interesting Western audiences. To reach the Iraqi people, IPC relied extensively on the press and cinema. In 1951, the company started to publish the monthly magazine Iraq Petroleum, and the first slide you've seen was from one of the covers, and Ahl al-Naft, Oil People, which until the 1958 revolution had a circulation of 20,000 and 48,000 copies approximately. A film unit was also established in Baghdad in 1951 with an annual production of approximately 10 documentaries that were screened in cinemas and schools and occasionally broadcast on national TV. Mobile cinema units also traveled to remote towns, refineries, and oil stations. According to IPC, 1 to 2/3 of the Iraqi population had seen IPC movies in the 1950s. These movies, as suggested by Mona Damluji, I mean, I've got a wonderful, a colleague was doing some fantastic work on cinema, early Iraqi cinema, oil companies movies. These movies, as suggested by Mona, did not depict oil in its crude and industrial form, but as a modernizing force able to transform land and people. One of the salient features of oil propaganda, as staged in the press, and I'm going to focus on the press here rather than on cinema, was that it portrayed the industry as a human-centered story of progress, a story which was often narrated from the perspective of the Iraqi employees of the company. Their productivity, corporate ethics, and new modern urban lifestyles featured prominently, for instance, in the magazine Iraq Petroleum. Articles such as this shown here, A Day in the Life of an Oilman, depicted the everyday experience of oil life as an ongoing process of social advancement and professional education. The main protagonists were young and upwardly mobile Iraqi employees of the company who occupied supervisory and clerical positions or had specific technical skill. This guy in particular, this is Sayed Abdul Wahid Ahmed, a junior operator in Kirkuk's process plant. Their stylized profiles presented the company as progressive, of course, forward-looking, and keen to invest in the future welfare of Iraq and of its people. With ample illustrative materials, photographs, but also drawings, this is not the case in this particular article, feature articles followed the work, family, and leisure routines across company spaces, from their private residences, okay, he's leaving his house, you look at the children here, to workspaces, to the classroom, where the oil company offered education, either English or technical skills or whatever, to the personnel office of the company. Now, the personnel company office of the company was quite important because it apparently distributed the supplied refrigerator, electric fans, and all these modern goodies that, of course, at that time were very much sought after. Now, presenting happy and accomplished workers was designed to advertise job opportunities in the oil industry for the many young and unemployed. This is also was one of the aims, it seems. It also, of course, served to popularize the benefit of oil progress to wider audiences. On the eve of the 1958 revolution, for instance, two independent media consultants advised IPC, I think they were BBC media consultants from the BBC, advised IPC to start producing programs for Iraq's national radio and TV, which featured professional portraits, including life stories of oil trainees and railway workers, of course the railway industry being the other major industry in Iraq, and also portrait of families who actually were blessed by the new development prosperity, particularly oil, including oil. So public and private spaces were used in this propaganda to depict the new corporate culture of oil development. Let's take, for instance, canteens and suburban villas. This crop up continuously in the brochures and publicity and publications. The provision of meals, of subsidized meal, in between shifts in a clean, modern, and organized environment was one of the first enterprises publicized by all companies throughout the Middle East. So it was the same for the in Iran, Kuwait, Bahrain, and also Saudi Arabia. By the early 1950s, all major centers of IPC oil production in Iraq had refectories which featured prominently in company publicities, publicity and brochures. In 1951, the company claimed that it had subsidized more than 2 million meals. Canteens were not only publicized as an entitlement of workers, but also as places of leisure and pleasure, places of socialization. I didn't have a photograph available from any of the Iraq, of the IPC magazines on of a canteen. I'm sorry about that. But let's move to the modern villa. Now, it was, however, the suburban villa, the key setting that defined new images of corporate life. By the mid-1950s, company magazines devoted considerable attention to housing developments sponsored by IPC or subsidized through home ownership schemes, which were supported by the company in Kirkuk. They started in Kirkuk, then Basra and Baghdad. And the one in this slide was, as you can see from the caption, was one of the houses supported in Basra. Villas were, in a kind of quite strange manner, were publicized as urban skylines in their own right, as suggested by a number of striking images of houses built by the company in the outskirts of Kirkuk as part of, again, this ownership scheme. Published in Iraq Petroleum, these images show an empty and desolate, as you can see, suburbia, which the caption, which you probably cannot read properly, describes as imaginative town planning. So they were putting quite a lot of effort in this. In fact, the company villa was the accessory that defined the image of IPC model employee. The modern design of new houses was often just opposed to the images of family life that popularized the archetypal oil household as a nuclear family. Publicizing moving-in days often served this purpose. An article published in 1958, again in Iraq Petroleum, shows an Iraqi family taking possession of a villa, again sponsored by the Basra Home Ownership Scheme, which actually started in 1953, it seems, and by 1958, between 250 and 300 houses were built. 4 years earlier, the Kuwait Oil Company, and just I put this actually just as a contrast, this, of course, the ownership in Basra, and these are a kind of the same images popularized by the Kuwait Oil Company in Kuwait of moving in days. This is in 1954 when actually they started the ownership scheme in Ahmadi, which is Kuwait Oil Town. And of course, the Kuwait Oil Company and the Iraq Oil Company were coming out of the same, so their policies were actually quite similar. Now, this type of advertising was also used to maximum effect to publicize show houses, model villas, in order to encourage prospective buyers. IPC employees were eligible to the scheme, and this is the show house. Again, it's Basra's coming up again. These articles are highly suggestive of how the company instructed its workers in the art of modern urban living. They included floor plans, as you can see here, so extremely professional and extremely modern. I mean, 1957. Pictures of fully furnished interiors, modern kitchens and dining rooms, linoleum floors, and built-in cupboards. So, in a sense, this propaganda, this imagery, represented workers' lives in an unprecedented way, entering personal spheres of leisure, pleasure, and family life. Of course, the stylized images of these spaces populated by company employees tell us very little about how company housing was perceived and lived, and how Hoyle propaganda affected taste and family and social behavior. This is the next part of the story, which I'm working on. I've so far some evidence of this, not much, and actually I'm sort of eagerly looking forward to meet anybody who knows anything or can tell me anything about oil life in Iraq in the 60s at least, or even in the 70s. Yet, Iraq Petroleum as a glossy magazine was, for instance, quite popular, as far as I understand, among the middle and upper classes, the Anglophile middle and upper classes. I've not been able to consult Ahl al-Naft, which was actually the Arabic publication of the company, as the only copy that I could locate is in the US. But I will do so. I've got basically only the table of contents of Ahl al-Naft. I've actually looked at their counterparts in Kuwait and Bahrain, Al-Kuwaiti and Najm al-Suwaiya. And I think, you know, it's actually quite interesting to contrast how the English press of the companies contrasted the press in Arabic in terms of representation of the workers. Now, I have some evidence, though, for instance, how residents experienced IPC accommodation in Kirkuk in the Arapa estate, in the old sort of camp of Kirkuk. The sparse layout of bungalows seemed to have added to a continuous feeling of danger, as residents often complained to IPC officials of insufficient police protection and the insecurity of modern houses. Some of the people feel scared because, of course, this kind of modern villas had, they were detached from each other, so there was no sense of protection and community. Now, expanding, going back to the happy images of Baghdad, expanding and fast-changing Iraqi cities featured prominently in the story of oil development, as by the 1950s, they constituted the sites, the places, where all modernity was starting to become visible to the public. In words and images, IPC celebrated the straight line of modernist public and private architecture, and, of course, also the orderliness and cleanliness of suburban districts and modern oil camps as the miracle of oil progress. Yes, here you have another striking sort of series of pictures of modernist architecture in Baghdad. And again, this is from 1957. What about Kirkuk? I've started all this with Kirkuk. Well, as to Kirkuk, Iraq Petroleum in 1954 described the city in the following terms. Quote, on every side there was evidence of boomtown activity. Much has been done over the years to transform into the city beautiful. Indeed, there are already many points of resemblance between Kirkuk and the modern dream city which Kemal Atatürk built in the middle of the Anatolian plain, of course, referring to Ankara, the capital of the Turkish Republic. End quote. This article ends emphatically with new towns for old, a new civilization for ageless Iraq. Oil was then, of course, presented as the catalyst of a nationwide civilizational and urban revolution. In the 1950s, Kirkuk was undoubtedly a growing and very fast-developing, fast-changing city. The population had increased from 40,000 in 1928 to 135,000 in 1957. Carriages pulled by horses were still in use as means of public transport, but a bus line linked central Kirkuk, the old town, to the Arapa estate. And by the early 1960s, a public bus network covered large portions of the city. Many streets were asphalted. Two new bridges were built on the Khazar River, The railway connected Kirkuk to Baghdad was extending northwards to Erbil, and a new road from Kirkuk to Baghdad was under construction. Now, some images of real Kirkuk. Well, I mean, this is old Kirkuk, actually. This is the citadel. This is the citadel, the old citadel of Kirkuk, and still, this is the old Ottoman bridge, stone bridge, which was built, I think, in the 1880s or 1870s, when Kirkuk was and Iraq was still under the control of the Ottoman Empire. This is a funny one. This is a postcard which was sent by some German tourists. Austrian tourist. This is 1958. This is March 1958. These Austrians were visiting Kirkuk and sent this postcard back home to Vienna. Here you see again the citadel. But this photograph, this picture is taken from the new bridge, and you see here only a part of it, which was built after 1954. The old Ottoman bridge collapsed, apparently. Now, okay, this is West Kirkuk. This is the city from the citadel. I think still with the old bridge. Very unclear when this photograph was taken. What I found quite difficult is find really real good images of modern Kirkuk, of modern facilities in Kirkuk, because even the images I found in the archives of the oil company were all about the citadel, of the traditional minarets and architecture and whatever. So this probably is 1940s, I would guess. This is not very good, but this is late 1950s, taken from the citadel, and you see the car, tarmac, and the new bridge. And this is a definite sign of modernity. This is the sort of the train station at Arapa, and obviously, you know, this train network was also developed to transport workers, and you can notice how the carriages are actually super modern. Well, what oil propaganda, and I'm going to tell you the less nice story in some ways, what oil propaganda concealed, however, were the physical and social landscapes of inequality created by the oil industry inside Kirkuk. Since the 1930s, in fact, the demand for labor led to the spontaneous development of new residential districts around the old town, districts that really never featured in IPC's magazines. Neighborhoods such as Mount Qasim and Al-Shorja provided the stage for the emergence of a dispossessed, turbulent, and in some cases politically inclined suburban proletariat that included many Kurdish immigrants of rural extraction by the 1950s. Now, this is a photo taken for the Life magazine of a Kurdish worker in Kirkuk, and is obviously somebody, given the traditional sort of headgear coming from the countryside. Growing class consciousness fueled ethnic animosities, particularly between Kirkuk's Kurdish and Turkmen population. Of course, Kirkuk historically has been a Turkmen city, a Turkmen town. But in the 1950s, Kurds came to constitute a larger proportion of the urban population and IPC's largest reservoir of menial labor. The growth of Kirkuk's suburban areas reveals sometimes traumatic experiences of rural-urban migration, both individual and collective. The squalid site and precarious economic and security situation of suburban Kirkuk, actually also we have to think that particularly after 1946, the whole political issue of the Kurdish movement as well, and of course Kirkuk was very affected as well, and so that's why security was quite tight. So the squalid site and precarious economic and security situation of suburban Kirkuk contrasted with the glamorous town that IPC had built in the Arab estates. Yet, yet. Even within the posh Arapa estate, social tensions seem to have loomed large. Arapa was one of the development projects devised by the company to diffuse mountain labor discontent after the strike of 1946 that I've discussed before. Typically for oil camps of this kind, the estate was organized in a corporate hierarchy as the quality, size, and layout of dwellings reflected salary scales, separating skilled from unskilled workers. By the early 1950s, the estate became the symbol for some of IPC discriminatory housing and employment policies. As Christians and Armenians, who constituted the bulk of IPC locally recruited clerical staff, benefited extensively, apparently, from the company's housing perks. That's what the correspondence is telling me. By 1953, Arapa had come to be perceived as IPC's Christian stronghold in Kirkuk. Resentment had escalated to an extent that members of other communities refused to live there. Also, there is evidence that many local Christians and Armenians, who lived in the Arapa estate, the threat of violence and intimidation by labor activists, criminals, and unskilled workers often materialized in the violation of their houses, thefts, and physical attacks. In other words, they reported some of the attacks to the oil company. That's how I could actually trace their existence. Well, the oil station, this is a plan of an oil station at T1, so the first, the first oil station on the Tripoli branch of the pipeline. Now, the oil station built along the pipeline were also presented by IPC branding, let's say, as evidence of the success of the company's industrial expansion. Again, Iraq Petroleum celebrated them as the harbingers of a new industrial future and the prototypes of the industrial city of the 20th century. They were portrayed as, quote, miniature oil towns, man-made oases of gray stone residential buildings with tree-lined avenues, gleaming silver tanks, oil depots, pumping houses, recreational facilities, administrative offices, schools, and supermarkets, end quote. Well, this is a kind of stylized plan, but basically here you have the quarters of the European, mostly British employees of the company with, I think, a tennis court here. And here you have the quarters of the Iraqi employees. You've got married quarters and bachelor's quarters that you had in all these oil towns. And here you have a football ground, obviously. You know, locals liked football, so that's why they put the football ground there. In the middle you have various industrial sort of facilities as well as sort of some shops and so forth. Also here, in spite of the kind of rosy pictures of this oil station presented by the oil company, and of course also as suggested by the work stoppages staged in 1937 and the takeover of K3 by labor activists in 1948, in the oil station also there was another side of story. Apart from the scenario of labor activism, in the oil station, which also, and this is very important, functioned as recruitment centers for the work camps that mushroomed along the pipelines, a complex system of tribal racketeering trapped casual laborers into a vicious cycle of poverty and subordination. Often, job seekers from neighboring towns and villages resorted to local moneylenders in order to raise the funds to pay employment fees, as the recruitment of casual workers relied on a number of local intermediaries. In particular, I think very important, at least until the 1950s, were actually Bedouin sheikhs, tribal leaders. I mean, this one was in a tribal area, but also K2 and K3. that actually function as the company's employment agents, mostly, interestingly, in connection with the policing duties they had exercised on behalf of the company since the construction of the pipeline. Now, in the 1952, I think things start to change because the government and the oil company decide to establish an oil police, which was partly subsidized by the company and by the government. So they started recruitment security personnel and policemen to guard the pipeline and the oil station. But until 1952, this seemed to have been the case. So, in sum, just to conclude, a blessing or a curse? Well, of course, the question is still very much open, at least, of course, for the period I have considered in this lecture. I venture, however, that it was both. So we don't have to look at oil necessarily as positively or negatively. But for many people, it was actually different. They had very different experiences of oil, and overall, the experience of oil in Iraq, at least in this period, was ambivalent, as it was in other areas of the Middle East with a very thriving oil industry. And I'll finish here.
Nalida, thank you so much. That was absolutely fascinating and marvellously evocative illustrations. And one could almost walk into those photographs and inhabit those landscapes and villas. I was also struck by the fact that this very modernist city was named Arapa after the ancient city. You know, we can never escape the ancient in Iraq, and it's there in the citadel as well, isn't it? But I'm sure lots of other people have questions too. We have time for a couple before we adjourn. I can see Erica Hunter has her hand up, and another lady at the side there.
Thank you, Nalida, for a very interesting lecture. I have two questions. The first is perhaps more social than the second. Do you know what has happened to the old fabled mess of the IPC that was still talked about?
That's the what?
The mess. There was a club, a members club.
I see.
Yes. That's my first
question. Okay, now. You want to know what's happened now.
Was it still running when I was in Iraq. Is it still functioning?
I don't know. That's perhaps other people would know.
The second is probably more critical. On what grounds do you use the terminology Christians and Armenians?
Ah, okay.
Because are they not Christians? Would it not be better to use perhaps two ethnic terms like Assyrians and Armenians, or use the one? It seems to be perhaps not consistent in your terminology.
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, I must say it's a very tricky one because both different type of records that I have used do use the word Christian in very generic terms. However, my sense is, and also this applies to the very few Jews who were actually left in Kirkuk by the 1950s. My sense is that most of these personnel that served the clerks, so they were slightly higher up in the actual sort of ladder, were Kaldani.
That may well be.
Yeah.
And there would be a much more nuanced framework, but I just found it quite enigmatic that you separated Armenians from the rest of the Christian population.
No, what I was saying is that from the company records, it seems that many of these individuals had jobs in a company, and therefore, because they had certain type of jobs, clerical jobs in the company, they were more successful in bidding for housing.
That I have no problem with, but I just think you might fine-tune your terminology. I realize that the company literature.
Erica, sorry to interrupt.
Sure. I mean, we can discuss it. I know you know much more than that.
Yeah, I think there are lots of other people want to join in there. But I think maybe there's also, if I might negotiate, I think what Nelly is talking about is the language used in the 1950s that doesn't necessarily reflect her categorization, but she's trying to capture
the language
of the 1950s.
Sorry?
Yes.
Oh, well.
We will move on. The lady stand, that Lauren is standing by has questions, and then we can all...
Okay, my name is Maryam Saloum. I come from the CISD, also SOAS. My question is, you're talking about blessing or curse, like paradox of plenty. And the question is, how much of the revenues was going to the Iraqi government? How much was going to the IPC? How much was going to... I think there was an Armenian guy you didn't even mention. He was one of the big bosses. And the second question is, 1941, we have the German involvement. I was just interested in how much the Germans played a role in re-diversing oil to Hitler.
Which kind of German involvement?
I mean, the 41 coup is a German involvement.
That triggered the war.
Yeah, I just want to know how much they were involved in the oil business. That's it. So well, German involvement in the oil business in 41, and how much of the revenues of the IPC went to the Iraqi government?
Well, okay, look, as I said at the beginning of this talk, I'm not going to talk about the... I'm not really an expert on the political economy of oil. What is very clear, though, and actually is very relevant to your question in this respect to the kind of propaganda I was discussing that starts at some point in the 1950s, that the renegotiation of the oil agreements in 1952, the actually Iraqi government got 50% of oil royalties, 50% to IPC and 50 to Iraq. So in connection with this, also you have the establishment of the Oil Development Board, which is a board, a sort of government board, which actually started to plan oil development with these revenues. And so, for instance, you know, they started thinking in terms of agricultural development, and that was one of their big issues and so forth. I can't give you precise figures, I'm afraid. Germany, I mean, seen from Kirkuk, from the war years, the only thing I can tell you is that there was continuous rumors of German airplanes flying over the city. And at some point, there was this amazing rumor that spread around town that there were four German parachuters who were actually roaming around town, who've just been parachuted from planes. I don't think there was any much involvement. There was a lot of espionage and aerial espionage at the time, but not actual involvement. There was a lot of paranoia, that's for sure. And actually, one can really understand the atmosphere of Kirkuk in the 40s, in particular, during the war, but after, with this incredible atmosphere of continuous rumor coming from the Kurdish area, from the tribal interland, from the oil stations. So it was a kind of complex city to understand, but I don't know of any direct German involvement.
Thank you. I think we have time. Yes, of course.
Thank you.
You mentioned you are interested in some more information about the life in Iraq. I have a quite large number of books of British travelers who lived in Iraq in different places. They have written fantastic description of the life in Iraq, the cities, the people, men, women, their dresses, the ethnic groups, and how they lived all in harmony. These books are fantastic. I keep reading them. I've collected them over the last 30 years while I lived in the UK. So I just mentioned the authors. You may be able to get these books. Lady Drawer.
She wrote
books. Her book was referred to in the latestly published book by Erwin Finkel at the British Museum. He wrote The Ark Before Noah. That book got reference to her book. And also Freya Stark, she is a traveler in the 30s. And Gavin Young, who lived in the marshes. And before him, Wilfred Thesiger. He wrote a beautiful book about the marshes. And in fact, Thesiger has lived in the marshes and he loved it. And he wished he lived all his life there. So these books, I think...
Thank you very much. I mean, there is wonderful literature. There is less literature, though, on oil, on the description of oil, oil towns, oil people, oil installation in English. I think that the literature in English, I've kind of covered it. What I am very interested in looking more at the Iraqi side now. But thank you. That's very useful.
Yeah. Super. Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. I know there are lots of people who have questions and comments for Nelida. It's very hot in here. I think it's time that we took some refreshment. But before we open the magic door to the drinks, I would like to ask our Vice Chair, Professor Charles Tripp, to formally thank Dr. Fucaro on our behalf. Charles, over to you.
Thank you very much, Eleanor. I know that I'm standing between you and the drink, so it's a very difficult and dangerous place, but I think I could only do something that gives me huge pleasure is to give a tribute to Nelida, my colleague at SOAS, for the extraordinary, interesting lecture. Since she referred rather tactfully at the beginning as those who have written about Iraq and have hijacked the history of oil to serve, as it were, the analysis of the political economy of Iraq and other places, I feel that I'm one of the hijackers. But I hijacked it because, of course, as we know, the revenues of Iraqi petroleum were hijacked by various powers. And the kinds of people that Nelida has been talking about and writing about so interestingly, of course, had very little say in that. And I think it's a wonderful tribute to not only, in a sense, Nelida's scholarship, but also to a proportion of the population of Iraq whose story is not often told. Oil is taken for granted, the revenues are taken away, and many of the people who have helped to produce it get very little share in it. So I think this is an extraordinary testimony to an unwritten part of the history of Iraq itself. And I think there's, in a sense, one of the great richnesses of Nelida's account was, of course, to open up lots of different avenues of exploration by looking at the histories of oil workers and so on. And there's just one final thought that struck me looking at some of those pictures of the Iraq Petroleum and the pictures of the modern developments was that, as Nelida said, petroleum produced possibilities, potentials, as well as social strife and other kinds of social problems. But one of the things that struck me was that can one attribute the immense talent of Iraqi architects to, in a sense, the liberation of the imagination made possible by oil wealth and by, in a sense, a notion of modernity that transformed Iraq completely. And I cannot think of a country in the Middle East that has been so gifted in terms of its architectural talent. So the next project, Nelida, is the social history of Iraqi architecture. But in the meantime, I wanted to thank you very much on behalf of all of us here for such an extraordinary and interesting and promising talk. Thank you very much indeed.